Hope everyone had a good first day and night last night. I know it was a long day. We ended up at around 10 o'clock last night, but welcome. We have a big day on tap today, and we're going to get it started with our player development panel, our moderator, who you all know, he's a regular here, Eduardo Perez.
I'm back.
Eduardo's with ESPN, we're SiriusXM, and I'll let him introduce his panelists. Like we've been doing, if there are any questions, there are cards in the back, and if you can just write the questions on them, Jeff will pick them up, and then he'll bring them up here to Eduardo. And so now, let's welcome our first panel.
And it's an honor for me to be here again, and again, I was introduced without saying that I played 13 years in the Major League, so I'll just say that right now and get it out of the way also. So, might as well start off with a couple laughs here and there, but it's an honor to be in this panel with two gentlemen. We were supposed to also have David Bell, but he had to cancel last minute. And it's Chris Getz from the Chicago White Sox. This will be your second year in as a head of player development in farm director.
Yes.
For the Chicago White Sox. And Andy McKay going into his third season as a farm director for the Seattle Mariners. And different routes for different folks. And to me, it was really interesting that we're in this panel. And Andy, I'll start off with you. The background is kind of unique.
Yeah.
For a farm director, there's a lot of everybody knows about the numbers, everybody knows about the talent of the players, but also your background. Could you tell us a little bit of when it comes to the mental side of it, the psychology aspect of how you incorporate into the players?
Sure. And you didn't mention my time in the big leagues.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't mention Chris's either. I was going to get to that, but I figured we'd do our own.
Eddie and I combined to play 13 years in the major leagues, apparently. there's some numbers for you. Numbers can lie, right? On average, you both played 6.5 years.
All right, he got in there already.
Thank you for having me. No, it's an honor to be here. I spent about 20 years as a community college baseball coach and teaching sports psychology in the academic setting there. We created a sports psychology program, and I did that for about 20 years. Then I went to the Colorado Rockies, where I ran their mental skills department for 3 years before coming over to Seattle. So, you know, a lot of times people will look at me, you know, hey, Seattle is pretty analytically driven. How does that mesh with, you know, sports psychology? And I think it meshes perfectly well. You know, players enjoy having data to drive what they're doing rather than someone's biased opinion to drive what they're doing. And we've been able to mesh the two very well. But if you understand basic psychology at all, you understand how biased human beings are. And so when you're able to take raw data and organize it in a way that can tell a story, that story tends to hit home a lot faster than one person's opinion. You know, so when you can sit with a minor league player and explain, look, you're carrying a strikeout rate in low A that nobody in the major leagues carries. And you show them the numbers, and that strikeout rate tends to start correcting itself really quickly. And that's totally different than me just saying, hey, look, you're striking out too much. So We've incorporated, analytics into everything that we do. We've also incorporated mental skills into everything that we do. And I'd be more than happy to talk about the mental skills part about it, but I think we're kind of here to talk about numbers.
No, we're here to talk about a lot of stuff.
Okay.
And thanks to you for letting me know that I do strike out a lot. appreciate it. At least he put his hand on me. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Chris, on the other hand, with the White Sox, going into your second season, you spent 2 years with the Royals, also as the assistant when it comes to in player development. And when you got the call to become the farm director after more than 13 and a half years combined between us and combined playing the game, how have you been able to translate what you learned on the field and then in the office with Kansas City to what you're doing right now in Chicago?
Well, you certainly try to use your own experiences, mine being playing. You know, I was a player that was drafted out of high school, chose to go to college.
Michigan.
I saw a Michigan shirt over here, too, so go blue. Drafted again out of college by the Chicago White Sox both times. Went through the minor leagues, made a stop at every level, made it to the major leagues, experienced being traded after my rookie year, was a challenge. Headed over to the Kansas City Royals. They were going through a rebuild at that time. And obviously, over time, you saw the successes that they eventually had, they had over there. Ended my career with the Blue Jays. And it was an up-and-down career, so certainly it wasn't just this glowing 7-year major league career. But with that being said, I experienced all of those things, and I would like to believe that certainly would help with communicating with our players, being that I lived a lot of the things that these guys are living right now. And then when I was done playing, I took a couple months off. Kansas City was open to bring me in the front office there in the fall of 2014, and all of a sudden I walk right into a World Series that following year in 2015 to experience that. It was a little bit of an interesting experience, being that I was a player there, and then once they got rid of me, they won the World Series. but it was a lot of fun to see that happen. And then the following year, getting more involved, getting exposed to the amateur scouting side, the pro scouting side, analytics side, just the processes that were going on there. And then I was fortunate enough to be looked at as a candidate for the White Sox farm director position. That offseason, sat down with Rick Hahn and Buddy Bell, and they hired me, and here I am today.
And we did spend some time in uniform together, right?
2007? Yes, and I've got a great story about this.
Oh, great.
So this was 2007,
mm-hmm.
And that was my first major league camp. You said that we were playing the Brewers. I swear we were playing the Rockies that day.
Chris Capuano, was he with the Rockies at the time?
All right, you win. Anyway, so I
know my lefties.
The reason we like analytics, yeah, so because the memories tend to fail us here.
Yeah. So, you know, Eddie Perez, I know who Eddie Perez is, and this is my first major league camp. I'm looking around. Well, anyway, and that was the tail end of your career, right? Was it not?
It was the end of my career.
Okay. So that day against the Milwaukee Brewers, we were at least on the road, right?
We were at home.
Even better. Okay, my credibility is just getting better and better up here. Anyway.
You guys should talk.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, he hits a home run that day. Well, on that swing, he happens to strain a calf.
There we go. You got that right.
Yeah, strain a calf. He could not run around the bases.
Yeah.
Now, so, I was not the one chosen off the bench to run the bases for you, but I remember Andy Gonzalez was.
Yes. Good, great memory.
Yeah. He crossed home plate, and then what we talked about earlier,
How are we supposed to score that? So, rounding first base, I could not move anymore. Great story. And I looked over, and Ozzie Guillen's like, he tells the bat boy, go run for him. The bat boy starts running towards me. I'm like, no. And the umpire's like, can't you just hobble? I said, I cannot move. Couldn't move. So Andy Gonzalez came in, scored the run, obviously did what he did at the plate. Like if he hit the home run.
That's right.
And
That's right. They
had to call Elias because they did not know how to score that. There were two runners on base. I wanted the RBI. So Andy Gonzalez ended up getting the run scored from Elias, that they told us. I ended up getting the home run and the three RBI. But I did not get the run scored. It's really interesting looking back. I wanted the run. But anyways, it was a lot of fun, and that was not the tail end, but the end. Last home run I ever hit, and I couldn't even run around the bases for it. And I got released, and that was it. And then now I'm here. Fast forward. How do you quantify it with your background? And I have all the notes here, and all of a sudden this turns off on me. The mental skills. How do you quantify that with a player?
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the, I guess, the $10 million question that people are trying to get to as we've we're kind of moving towards the human analytics era, I think. But, you know, I think it was Einstein who said that not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. I think we're going to hit a wall here as an industry where as much as we want to be able to assess and put a number on makeup or on toughness, I don't think we're ever going to get there. And I think that's just part of the game that we're going to have to be humble and understand that while it probably is the most important part of the game, it's always going to be a little esoteric and it's going to fluctuate a lot because we're dealing with human beings. We're not dealing with robots. And, you know, I think you can, you know, when you assess a player and you say he is mentally tough, well, toughness is really a situational thing. Focus is a situational thing. So you can be really mentally tough and battle in and at bat and then go out on the field and give it away. And so I don't know that we will ever get to a place where you can actually say, you know, on a 20-80, this is a 70 competitor. It just doesn't work that way. And I think there's probably 30 front offices that would like to crack that code somehow. But we know in every endeavor, whether it's the Major League Draft, the NBA, the NFL, picking a CEO, we're missing more than we're hitting. And we're usually missing based on these soft skills of competitiveness, ability to focus, things like that. So,
and yesterday we spoke about even the neuroscience of the game. A lot of questions were asked about that.
Correct.
And again, questions, we all that were here yesterday, notes in the piece of paper, please pass them along. And later on, 20 minutes before I'll stop, before we're supposed to quit, so we can get some of your questions in also. But with the mental scale, when it comes to the neuroscience of it, each organization is doing some, they're putting their
footprint.
Some variation of it. With your background, what kind of variation are you guys doing, or is this like a top secret here?
There's no secrets. I mean, we all want the same thing. We want, as a hitter, we want hitters who can get into the batter's box.
I can do that.
You can do that physically.
Oh,
okay.
No
man. And have a plan. Okay. And then over the course of those 4, 5, 6 pitches of that at bat, to continually recommit to that plan. And that's where it gets lost. So, you know, you, for example, you have a hitter who walks up to home plate. And to be honest, most hitters, their plans are very, very similar. You know, we're looking to get something over the middle of the plate and drive the ball in the air back towards the middle of the diamond. Okay? That's a pretty general plan that most hitters will take. So you walk up to home plate, and that's your goal. That's your intent. Okay? First pitch is kind of a get it in there, steal a strike, breaking ball. And you take it 0-1. Okay? Hitter steps out. Thoughts start spinning. Okay, this guy's going to breaking ball me to death. Okay? Well, right then, the plan is gone. Or he's thinking, there's strike one. I'm not going to get to 2 strikes. Right there, the plan is gone. So how many of these pitches? On average, a hitter is going to see 16 pitches a night on average. How many of those 16 pitches can he be in the batter's box, absolutely committed to his plan? And in my work, I will tell you that the best hitters on good nights will come back and they will self-assess at 8 or 9 of those pitches they were really locked in for. And how you would ever actually quantify that, I don't think you can.
Chris?
Well, I think, you know, so often as a player, and then you kind of assess what you have in your system, you've got guys that are able to continue that focus, whether it be in the box or in the field. And so often it's been the guys that have been able to do that are the ones that separate themselves and they become the successful players. Now it's our job to be able to teach these guys, to be able to grow these guys into guys that can develop that skill set. We can't. It's not the sink or swim type approach anymore where it was in the past. So we've brought in as many people as we can to as a support system to help these guys. I would ideally like to have all our hitting coaches have that skill set, all our pitching coaches to be well-versed in that area, but that's not always the case. So for organizationally, we've taken an approach to start educating our staff so they can have those conversations, because ultimately those conversations with the players are happening so often in the batting cage. Sometimes they're happening in the training room. Sometimes it's on the bus. Sometimes it's on a flight. So the more we're having those conversations, then it becomes part of our everyday living. And hopefully, as a result, those players are able to continue that focus, because we know how important it is.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, listening to both of you, and when I was with the Cardinals and I was playing, there was one game I was playing and they tried to hide me in right field, and I'm warming up down the line, and Mark McGwire is next to me, and it's a packed stadium, and everybody knew that the Cardinals opened the gates early so they could watch Mark McGwire take batting practice. It was a show. There was like 25, 30,000 people already there, even before an hour, two hours before the game started, just to watch in and all the batting practice of Mark McGwire. And we all knew it. And when the game started, it was a packed house. Before, you know, the runners run down the line, we're going back and forth getting loose, and Mark asked me a question. And he said, how many of these people are here to see you? I was like, dude, really? I'm number 33. I don't think anybody even knows or reads my name in the back. They're here to see you. And he goes, that's why you're you and I'm me. I make sure that I have to give my A game every day. I have to be mentally prepared. And that's a guy that was always focused. He visualized everything. But he made sure that the people that traveled, if it's 4 or 5 hours, if they flew for the weekend, if they saved their money all year to come see the Cardinals and see Mark McGwire, he needed to perform every at-bat, every pitch. He needed to be focused. He goes, from now on, they're all here to see you. And it actually changed my career. You look at it. Every time I went up to, every time I was in that lineup where I used to be like scared to death, oh, please don't hit it to me, now it was, I got to perform because they're here to see me. And I try to tell every young player the same story wherever they're from. I always take that moment to tell them the Mark McGwire story. And I even told Mark last year, and he's like, hey, I'm going to use that with my Padre players. You're right. And for me, it worked. And there's always a mental edge to a guy not being able to throw at-bats away. So you can definitely relate to all of those. Now, you mentioned the players hitting the ball in batting practice, and you mentioned in the air.
Correct.
When I played, we never heard that. We're like, hey, let's go line drive. Stay through the ball,
yep.
Hit it hard. We never heard exit velocity. We never heard launch angle. And you mentioned that, and yesterday I was at the Brewers complex in the morning, and they had a screen that you can't hit it too high because it's not going to leave the cage, but if you hit it too low, there's screens all around the infield. It's not going to leave the infield. You want that angle. Again, when I played, we never saw that. Chris, when you played, you never saw that either. This is new. You're saying air. How do you teach that? How does the mental approach now change for a player that came up through Little League, through if it's early on in the minor leagues? How are you teaching that at the minor league level?
Well, again, let's go back to from the history of the game. Line drives have worked, right? We know that. And hitting the ball hard in the air, I mean, line drives are in the air, right? So in one aspect, it's like there's nothing new here. Okay? But in another aspect, there is, because we can quantify four players. You know, when you take their exit velocities, you can now kind of determine an optimum ball flight. And it just makes sense. The harder you hit the ball, the more loft you can get to try to put it over the fence. We understand that. But, you know, I coached many years where I was coaching a very steep approach and kind of an A to B and get on top of the baseball and keep it out of the air approach. I did it for a long time. And just over the course of time, you know, I had an aha moment in Colorado. We were in a meeting, and we were kind of an org meeting, and obviously in Colorado, you're dealing with elevation, and we're trying to find pitchers who can sink it and keep the ball on the ground and so forth and so on. And a guy kind of taps me, and he says, if we're trying to get all of our pitchers to keep the ball on the ground, why do we teach our hitters to hit it on the ground too? And I said, oh gosh, that kind of hit me hard. You know, it makes sense. And then, you know, through a lot of numbers, and, you know, last year in Seattle, we had signed Gerard Dyson and looked at what happened when Dyson put the ball on the ground. And it wasn't good. You know, and that kind of led to a much deeper study of, really, there's nobody in the history of the game who's done anything productive on the ground. And we're clearly living the era of elevate the baseball and get it in the air. So just very fundamentally, you change the swing path a little bit. But it starts with just educating players. And I think the shift has probably been part of this, you know, that you have to hit it over a shift. And it's not as hard as you would think. One of the things that we've been able to show our players, and again, it's not a secret, in the history of the game, if you put the ball in play on a good count, the ball goes in the air. You don't even really have to try. It just goes in the air. When big league hitters put a ball in play on a 2-1 count, it goes in the air. You know, when they put a ball in play with two strikes, it usually goes straight up or it goes straight down. Again, that's just basic baseball. So you can really control your launch angle and your exit velocity simply by hitting good pitches and good counts. And again, that hasn't changed in the history of the game. What do you think, Chris?
Well, no, it's funny you bring up Gerard Dyson.
I'm sorry. Yeah. What do you think, Chris?
He's taking over as the moderator.
I know, right?
Well done. You bring up Gerard Dyson, which is funny because I played with Gerard Dyson, right? Granted, it was at the major league level, but in the minor leagues, they certainly told him, hit the ball on the ground. They were trying to hit the six hole and we'll beat this thing out.
Well, Ichiro style, right, guys?
And I was a guy that could run a little bit, not like Gerard Dyson, who's an 80 runner, and I was probably six at best. I'd like to think it's at least a six. But anyway, with that being said, okay, I'm a six runner, and I've got coaches telling me to hit the ball to the six hole on the ground. Okay, we get to the major league level. That's an out. All right, I'm sorry. I mean, it might be close, but it constantly became out after out after out. It just wasn't happening. I used to talk to Dice about this, and this is an eight runner. I mean, obviously you can start positioning the shortstop in different places and the second baseman. They can move in, they move over, and same thing, and out, let alone the psychological side of that whole thing where I'm in the box. You know, I've grown up, you know, feeling that I can drive the ball here, I can pull the ball over here, and you feel like, sorry, a man in the box, and all of a sudden they're telling me to hit on the ground. And Dyson, although the coaches were thinking, well, this is a way to get on base, well, it kind of took his kind of manhood away from him in the box, thinking, hitting the ball on the ground. All of a sudden he said, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore, and he started pulling the ball a little bit more. He started driving the ball a little bit more, and all of a sudden he started getting those line drives through the six, low line drives over there, and it became he opening up the field, using his speed, all the things were happening. He wasn't just limiting himself in that approach. Now, Dyson was way better player than myself, much more talented. I wasn't able to make those adjustments. That was just based on my shortcomings. However, here we are today, and we're talking about, you know, exit velocities and optimal launch angles with the exit velocities. You know, we preach kind of a high line drives. Once again, line drives are line drives. We believe in line drives. Now, one thing that I still kind of battle with, I'll be honest with you, because, and this kind of goes back to my personal experience and talking to a lot of, you know, talented players in the game, how you work, it's a very controlled environment. There's not a lot of emotion in the cage, in the batting cages. So balls that you were hitting at a certain angle, certain exit velocity, will change in the game based on anxieties, adrenaline, things like that. Your body starts doing certain things. Well, all of a sudden, you start rotating a little bit more, and your miss is now way up in the air. These are pop-ups. So I think there's an actual optimal angle on where your work should be, and then optimal angle in the game. If you focus on where you are, where you should work in practice, that should then correlate to something positive in the game. But yeah, those are all factors that are talked about now daily, which was not talked about a couple of years ago.
All right. Chris, I want to start with you again on this question. Continue with this, and adding on to that is we're seeing more and more, and you had mentioned earlier, Andy, about pitchers trying to get the ball down, yet we're seeing more and more hitters in today's game being able to handle that pitch down and actually striking out a lot more on pitches that are in the quadrant, in the upper third quadrant, on swinging and missing. Last year, if I'm not mistaken, it was Anthony Rizzo. Anybody can raise their hand and say you're wrong with when it comes to exit velocity hard down in the zone. He was the top guy. Mike Trout is a notoriously low ball hitter, and people started exploiting the upper part of the zone against him because there were holes there. We're striking out at an alarming rate. Yes, fastballs are faster. Pitchers are getting stronger. But at the same time, are there more holes in their swings because of this let's elevate the baseball? And how does it translate? And you were talking about translating from batting practice to more energy, more anxiety at the plate. How do you tell your minor league players and how do you develop them to say, listen, this is who you are and this is what we want you to do with it, but there are still going to be holes in your swing?
Well, I think you need to individualize this, right? I mean, you need to identify what this Gerard Dyson needs to do, what an Eric Hosmer has to do, an Abreu. Okay, Abreu needs to drive the ball. We can handle the strikeouts there. Now, Gerard Dyson, so to speak, or let's take it back to a minor league guy that might compare to a guy like that. Okay, he needs to make contact a little bit more. He needs to put the ball in play because his room for error may allow him to get on base. Now, there are guys that, with that, we need the guy to drive the ball. We need those home runs, those doubles, those gap-to-gap type hits that are going to come with the strikeout because we're okay with that strikeout as well because if this guy will just maybe potentially take his hit over here, when he gets to first base, what do we do with that guy? Okay, now it's going to take a couple hits to score him. So I really do think it's case to case, but I will say with guys that have really taken to kind of this, the focusing on an attack angle and launch angle at a very young age, we tend to see a lot of this, the swing and miss, and it just, at some point, some of these guys that are coming in at 17 and 18 that are taking that approach already, I have a little bit of a concern on. Now, further down the road, when they've kind of refined or have a better, more foundational type swing, now they start implementing a little bit more, I would rather take that approach just because I think they have a better chance to be a more complete hitter. But like I said, it is case to case, and it's something that we're talking about all the time, and we're applying it in our minor league system right now.
Yeah, I think the key, Chris, what you brought up, is it's an individual thing, and it's to put a blanket statement on it is impossible. But when you kind of dive into an individual player and you look at, based on this person's profile, how much strikeout are you going to be able to absorb and live with? And that's going to be different for each player based on the amount of damage he can do, et cetera. But I don't like strikeouts. It's kind of the only outcome a hitter can have that guarantees nothing good is going to happen. And I think more important than the swing changes that we're seeing and the kind of the elevate and celebrate that we're living through, it's just become acceptable to strike out. And that hasn't been the case. And there's a lot of different opinions on it, but I really believe that, we look at pitchers. Pitchers have to master two deliveries, a windup and a stretch. I think hitters can master two approaches and swings, which is a less than two strike approach and a two strike approach. It's the same thing. And I think across the industry, when we start kind of demanding guys find a way to put the ball in play with two strikes a little bit more, I think you'll see the strikeout numbers go down. And, but again, every player is different. But what ends up happening is you have players, take the Mariners, for example. Obviously, if Nelly Cruz is going to strike out X amount of time, you're going to live with it and you're going to absorb it based on what you're going to get from it. But, power is really hard to find in this game. And so you have hitters that don't quite have that skill set that are still being able to strike out at the same level, and that just doesn't work for the player. So I'm not a fan of striking out. I do like to see hitters make physical adjustments. I do like to see them make mental adjustments and fight to put the ball in play, because we understand when you put the ball in play, you have a chance of something good happening.
I'm glad you mentioned pitching, because I don't like too much pitching, but we have to talk about it, and it's the right thing to do here. And it's the development of pitching. Everybody, you know, you want to develop starters, yet starters pitch on every fifth day, where relievers, and you don't really get them in game action as much as relievers get game action and experience. What's more beneficial to you, having a guy that can go out there 30 or 35 more times during a regular season, or developing that starter that will get in a minor league season maybe 20 plus starts in the season? Isn't game action more beneficial, or is it more bullpens that are beneficial for that guy to be able to develop?
Well, the game, you have to have starting pitching to win. I mean, it's really, and you obviously we're seeing an era of some super bullpens, and how bullpens are being used is changing. But you know, most of your major league relievers were minor league starters, certainly at the younger levels. And so, you know, your point is well taken. You know, getting out there more rather than sitting for 4 days in between. But to develop pitches, it's hard to develop pitches in one inning outings. You know, the guy who has a chance to go out there and throw 75, 85, 95 pitches, and, hey, we're going to throw 10 changeups tonight. You know, I need to see, you know, every left-hander is going to have to see a cutter tonight. Those things are just impossible to do in one-inning bursts for the most part. And, you know, again, I think you're seeing Major League General Managers can do a pretty good job of assembling a competitive bullpen based on what's out there on the market. Those pieces can plug and play all over the place. It's putting together five starting pitchers that is the challenge for everybody. And I at least in our organization, any pitcher that we think has a chance to start, they start for as long as they possibly can. And then move into the bullpen based on either how they recover, based on they can't get through a lineup a second time, based on they don't have a third pitch that's usable. But the only way you're going to find that out is to keep them starting for as long as possible.
Yeah, we do the same thing. We do whatever we can to continue the development of a starter. I mean, we're going to exhaust that effort. I mean, I had a conversation yesterday with a kid or with one of our coaches. Guy has a big arm, pretty good delivery. You like the secondary pitch, but he's got a changeup that just needs a lot of work. The easiest thing to do for me is put that guy into the bullpen, and he'll potentially just shoot through our minor league system, and maybe he'll help us at the big league level. And this is a high A pitcher, but in my mind, we're doing the organization and the kid a disservice by just putting him in the bullpen, because that changeup's just not going to get any better. So we've made the decision to keep him as a starter at high A. You know, it's as these players come into our organization, and obviously we have backgrounds on these guys based on scouting reports and just past history. Certainly we'll have guys based on their delivery. If there's a lot of effort in the delivery, maybe it's a guy we will just put right into the bullpen. But if we like the delivery and he's got the makings of, you know, three average pitches, hopefully at least an above average pitch, we're going to do everything we can to develop him as a starter. You know, I think the playoffs are very interesting, because you watch these games. It's late in the year. You know, all you have to do is get that starter through five innings, and then you shut the door with these four relievers that come into the game. They're throwing upper 90s with big sliders and potentially another wipeout pitch. I mean, we did it in Kansas City. Once we got to the playoffs, it was you know, Kelvin Herrera, Wade Davis, Greg Holland. All we had to do was get through five, six innings. Ryan Madsen was a shutdown at that time. But we couldn't – there was no way we could get through a full season if we took that approach. We needed more innings out of our starters. There's no question. So, You know, I think it's just our duty on the minor league level and as an organization as a whole to continue to get these guys that can go deep into games, you know, and challenge these guys to be able to pitch through high-stress situations when they're at pitch 100 and 110 because in the long run it's very helpful when you're trying to win a championship.
It's no secret that your organization is probably in the top five when it comes to prospects, and you've been pretty much given the key to see the development of these young players. At what level do the analytics come into play when you start evaluating these players? It's because we all know a ball is more development, just go out there. But at what level do you say, okay, we need to implement a certain stat to see if it works, or a certain number to see if it translates and it works at the major league level when it comes to being able to get that player to the big leagues?
Well, every player, whether it be a kid in rookie ball up into AAA, the last couple of years we've just been collecting information on these players. Fortunately, whether it be, you know, TrackMan or Rapsodo machines or any of these pitch effects type things, but TrackMan has provided great information for us. So, you know, let's say, for example, on a weekly basis, we will get we'll send out to all our coaches, you know, a contact rate on certain pitches, swing and miss in the zone, out of the zone, and compare them to the rest of the league. You know, we'll have the averages above average, below average. See where they stand in that league, and then we'll do kind of a weekly and then a monthly. Our coaches are getting that information all the time. If a guy has a below average contact rate on a curveball, obviously the sample size is very small early on, but if we keep on seeing this as we move into the season, those conversations now, you know, we get into the cages or our work that day. Okay, what's going on here? We need to make an adjustment here so we're a little bit, we can close that gap and hit that curveball just so this doesn't become a larger issue as we move down the road. Now the debate is, okay, how much of this information does the player need to see? I would like to think that through our coaching, if we effectively communicate with the player that they understand that this adjustment needs to be made without seeing that data. Now, if we can't get the player to buy into that, then we do show them that data. And then we also will post things in the clubhouse of this information. Now, I don't focus on putting all of that information of every player there, but I might be a leaderboard just to make these guys aware of what's important and what we value. But we're doing that at every level, expose our coaches constantly with that information. And that's from more of a hitting aspect. Now on the pitching side, once again, we have all our pitchers that have been assessed. We know what those pitches do. I think it's important for those pitchers to understand how their pitches work. You know, we had a guy, one of our top prospects not too long ago, talking about his two-seamer. The guy thinks his two-seamer is a fantastic pitch. Well, it's not. It's not a good pitch. And here's the data to show it. But it's very important for our coaching staff to be educated and well-versed in it so we can have that conversation and let them know, you know, that's not maybe a good pitch in that scenario. Your four-seam works very well with your curveball there, your changeup, and because of your vertical and horizontal movement, this is the stuff that's working for you. So maybe let's eliminate that pitch, not completely eliminate it, but maybe use it less in that situation. And the goal there, you know, too, is hopefully we're finding value in guys that we weren't finding value in before. Maybe that marginal guy is now an average. Maybe that average is, maybe we can make him an above average pitcher. Maybe we're extending careers for these guys now that we're having this information. And that's kind of the approach we have. Now, with that being said, I'm still a firm believer that fastball command is very, very important, especially in a young pitcher. So I'd really want them to understand and throw his four-seam fastball to both sides of the plate. I don't want him to kind of have this immediate kind of escape hatch of two-seamers and sliders too early on in a career, because I think that can hinder the long-term development of the guys, or developing cutters too early on. But eventually some guys may need those pitches, and I think as they move up, we certainly will have those conversations and implement them into the repertoire. But I know that was kind of a long-winded answer on how we're approaching analytics in the minor leagues, but I view player development, I view my job and our coaches, we're problem solvers, and we're just trying to get to the solution as quickly as possible, and it's this stuff is really helping.
Is yours going to be that long?
Sorry. Go.
That's okay. No, I think the one thing I'll add to that is most of the numbers that we believe in and that we use to teach, it's shocking how quickly those numbers stabilize and show who the player is. And what I mean by that is you'd be very surprised at how small of a sample you need of, say, swing and miss before that number is highly predictive. So all your different numbers, they have different rates at which they stabilize and become predictive. I'm always blown away at how small of a sample you actually need and before it's saying this is who the player is. And, you know, we tend to have a much our drafts are fairly college-oriented. Most of those high-profile college players, they've already told you who they are. And that's not my opinion. That's what numbers are backing up. So, you know, players who control the strike zone in the SEC tend to control the strike zone in professional baseball. We know that strikeout rates do nothing but go up. You know, nobody strikes out less as they get to the big leagues. So we use the information a lot because, again, it doesn't take a big sample before you kind of know who the player is. Now, until the player changes, and players can change. You know, they can go through a swing overhaul. They can find a new pitch. They can change their bodies. So there's things that they can do to fundamentally change who they are. But if they're not doing that, then it doesn't take long to know who this player really is. And that's just because of how data has been organized and how it's become predictive.
Chris, yesterday it was, I'm going to go to the questions now, so these will be fun. Bear with me if I don't understand the handwriting, but this one's very clear. Yesterday it was pointed out that the shift in player positioning means players with range don't have to rely on it as much. Are we at the point where we're willing to sacrifice range in favor of analytic-driven positioning?
I would say yes. And I say that what really stands out to me, I think, obviously you need to believe in the data that you have. And we've done a pretty good job at the major league level on positioning our guys and the success rate we've had. Now, when you have guys, for example, second baseman, okay, typically in history, I'm saying that's about myself, being that I was a second baseman, always felt that I had to have pretty good range at second base to cover a lot of ground. Certainly being around the bag was a key for a second baseman, being able to, when you were being taken out by a runner. Now we can have guys that maybe aren't as mobile over in a certain position, over on that second base side, because when you believe in the information, we kind of can just plant a guy over there. Obviously, he needs to have a skill set to field the ball, be able to still turn the double play and make outs. But I think it's becoming a little bit more apparent that we can have a guy that's not the typical rangy type guy in certain parts of the field. So I think that we're onto something there.
Andy.
Yeah.
Is there a negative mental effect of the shift on pitchers? Is there an effort in the lower levels to get pitchers more comfortable with it?
Yes and yes. Pitchers and pitching coaches in general do not like the shift. And it's just, again, it's tradition. And when you're on that mound and you need a ground ball and you get that ground ball and it rolls through where your shortstop used to be standing for the last 150 years, they tend to remind you of that when they come off the field. And that's why you'll see, you know, I mean, the Chicago Cubs didn't do a lot of shifting last year, and they went back to a fairly more traditional alignment. But, you know, so what we've done yet, we shift very hard starting in Everett in our rookie leagues, trying to kind of redefine and let our pitchers understand, you know, you're never going to see those players behind you in that straight up defense that you grew up. We will never play our players there. They're always going to be in different positions. But we keep a running count for our pitchers to show them basically a plus and minus. And, you know, when you do follow the data and you position your players the most effective way, you're always going to be in a plus in terms of runs saved. And it just takes some time for pitchers, to get used to that. And, you know, they certainly don't have a problem when Robbie Cano picks up a ground ball 100 feet into right field and throws the guy out at first base. But it's hard. I mean, I understand what it'd be like to be out there as a pitcher, too, and need that double play ball, and you get it, and now you're in trouble with a run in and guys on the corners and one out rather than being out of the inning. So I understand that.
It's interesting you mentioned Chicago Cubs, because I asked Joe Maddon before a game, a Monday night game, about that question. You guys aren't shifting as much, and he says, well, there's two things. We actually are. It's just not that specific as it was once before. And when you have Javi Baez and you have Addison Russell up the middle and you have athletes, you allow them to be athletes. So you're right. It really depends a lot on who you have there. Next question, I think this one should go to you on this one. What would be the added benefit of quantifying mental skills above what mental skills coaches are already doing?
I think, like anything, if you could, which I think we've stated earlier, I don't think it's possible, but, you know, if you could assign some type of number, like he's a 70 runner, to say that he is a 70 competitor, well, now you have a standard that you're working off of, you have a baseline to work off of. So there would be value in that. I just don't think we'll ever get to that point, because, again, we're humans, and nobody's the exact same person every day.
Chris, why has the pipeline to the major league switched to double A while triple A is more of a wait and see level? Or do you agree with that question?
I don't think we're quite there to say that double A is kind of the level right before you send guys up to the major league level. Certainly, if we feel that a guy is ready to make that leap, we sent, I think, one player last year up to the major leagues from AA. AAA, I think it's kind of a year-to-year thing, because I look at the way we're kind of set up right now and where our prospects are. We tend to be more kind of the AA, high A level, where AAA, based on how the offseason is, has gone, and granted, this is just our organization, and we're kind of in a rebuild type phase. We have a young team, so our AAA team will be most likely filled with guys that, if these young guys kind of falter, there's some setbacks or some injuries, that we have some guys with major league experience at that AAA level, and maybe those prospects at AA or high A aren't the guys to fill in. I think that AAA will probably be the pool that we're drawing from more. But that's just us. I can't really speak for the other organizations. There's a lot of different factors, but this year that's how it applies to us.
All right, Andy, I don't think this question's for you. So, besides guys like Kopech and Eloy Jimenez in the system, who are a couple guys that we should be on the lookout for in the White Sox farm system? Spill the beans.
We've Alec Hansen, a pitcher. He's a guy that we got from Oklahoma a couple years ago. He was a high-profile guy going into his draft year. We were fortunate to get him in the second round, and he's taken off since we got him. Our pitching coaches have just done a phenomenal job with this kid, and he's got 3-plus pitches. First of all, he's 6'7". With good stuff. And this guy, being that he's a larger guy, his delivery sometimes can be challenging, but when the guy is in sync, he's got a chance to be a frontline guy. He's set to be a AA this year. Dylan Cease, a guy that we acquired in the Cubs trade, along with Eloy Jimenez, is an interesting arm, big arm, very good curveball. He's had a very good major league camp. He's opened some eyes there. He's a great competitor. He'll be at high A to begin the year. He still needs to develop his changeup. so often these young guys are can get by with just that.
Is that that kid you were talking about, the changeup? You just let us know, right? Changeup, he needs more.
Well, it's actually funny you bring that up because, our major league pitching coach, who would love to just have some of these arms in his bullpen, right, where organizationally, okay, we need to slow things down. This guy has a chance to be a frontline-type starter, but those are two guys right there. I think that stand out. Luis Robert, who we just acquired on the international front, we didn't really get to see a lot of him last year, just being based on the timing of things. Spring training has been
a grand slam. Didn't he hit a walk off?
He hit a grand slam the other night.
Yeah, off of grand slam, right?
Yeah, it wasn't a walk. Yeah, it was grand slam. But he on an off speed pitch. To be honest, I didn't know what to expect. I expected big tools. He played in the DSL last year and he controlled the zone. He's had a lot of professional at bats. So while he's been here, so very exciting player. I don't know how quickly he's going to move. But I must say that it's been really fun to watch him.
And I'm going to hybrid this question because I know we're almost at the last minute. It says here, describe the challenges of developing players from different backgrounds. And specifically, I want to go more into the minority aspect of this. I want to touch on the African-American community. I think it's very important. How can the organizations be able to go scout, get more of that talent into baseball, then develop that talent at the minor league level the same way that organizations are doing it with Latin American foreign-born players? How can we touch our African-American community?
Yeah, and it's a great question. It's something that we've discussed a lot in our organization, and I think the answer is that it's probably not an organizational issue. It's a baseball issue. And what the Seattle Mariners, the Chicago White Sox can do alone, I'm not really sure. But MLB as a whole, I know that we're certainly working in those areas. But for me, it's the participation rates of African-American players in youth leagues. And I coached at an inner-city junior college for 20 years, and I saw what happened over a 20-year period of participation rates, going from years where 40-45% of your roster being African-American to at the end being zero. And so, it's not an issue of going out and scouting different places. You have to have more African-Americans playing the game of baseball to be scouted, would be my opinion. So why have those participation rates declined? I don't really have an answer for that. But I do think it's going to take an effort of all of MLB to begin to reverse the course that we're certainly on right now.
How are you developing then culturally? And we talked about this yesterday also, with culturally when it comes to, and you mentioned the Dominican Summer League and Luis Robert, and how do you develop that transition to come to the U.S. to be able to understand how not only to be effective on the field but off the field and be able to get the most out of that player?
It's been an initiative of mine and the organization to make that transition easier for these players. You start with the education process, for one, helping these guys learn English. So when they come over here, they're a little bit more comfortable communicating. I'll take this back to my playing days, and I'm sure you can kind of attest to this as well. But so often when you were in clubhouses, you had essentially one side, were the American kids, and then you had the Latin American kids, all these divides.
And then you had me in the middle.
And yeah, of course. That's actually a great point.
On the training table with my calf.
Well, okay. Yeah, that's right. I was a part of teams that had that divide. Now, the teams that were more successful were less divided. And it was really important, for example, with the Kansas City Royals, Eric Hosmer was a great bridge. He just was. Bilingual kid. He had the personality. He was a good player. And he really helped blend the group together. I just felt like that was a void at the major league level. It was a void at the minor league level. We are attacking that. We've brought in people. Just hired a guy, Ben Broussard, who's kind of taken this kind of cultural development angle to us, where we're starting to, you know, do activities with an American kid and a Latin American kid. He's taking them out to eat, but we're also making fun events at the field to kind of bring those guys together. But I want that to start down at the Dominican, at the academy. In instructional league, we brought some of our American guys after our instructional league here in Arizona. A handful of those guys did an instructional league down there in the Dominican, spending time with those guys, integrating with those guys. So when they come over here, they're just a little bit more comfortable. Because you obviously fight there is some homesickness. I mean, it's such a cultural change. And when I was playing, you know, I just didn't have an understanding of the backgrounds. And now that I've really dove into this job, and this is one of the coolest parts of this position, is spending more time in these Latin American countries and learning about these backgrounds and just the passion that these guys have. And with this better understanding of where they come from, now I understand, okay, that's why he likes that type of music or that type of food, and just a better understanding of the personalities. But if we can get more of the players here in the States to understand those backgrounds, I mean, it'll make the transition easier for those Latin American kids. But as a whole, when they get to the big leagues, we have a chance to really have really good, solid chemistry to win a championship.
You know what's interesting, and you mentioned backgrounds, cultural backgrounds. I was actually in a meeting with an organization where they're saying, "Oh, this kid, he just doesn't look at us in the eye when we're trying to explain something to him. When we're reprimanding him, he doesn't look at us in the eye, always looking down." And I said, "Where's the kid from?" And he said, "Oh, he's from the Dominican Republic." And I said, "Well, you guys realize that in the Latin culture, especially Dominican Republic, Cuba, Venezuela, and Puerto Rico, your elder is talking to you, your superior is talking to you, and as a sign of respect, you actually listen and look down. Your parents tell you immediately, don't look at me, don't look at my face." Where here in the U.S., the culture is different. It's keep eye contact. So I was like, actually, it's a sign of respect. It's not actually a sign of him trying to tell you that he's not paying attention to you. So in other words, the cultures are very important to be learned, and being able to go down and seeing their background, I think, is huge. And final question, and I have two, but I have to pick one because we're already past the 9:30 mark and then some, but it's Puerto Rican time here and I'm in charge, so I'm going to go a little bit longer. All right, here we go. Last question. Is there a continuity of an organizational approach? Example, this is the Mariners or White Sox way through the minor leagues.
Yes and no. You're trying to create an identity for your organization. You're trying to create some boundaries. The way I like to put it is when a Mariner affiliate bus rolls into the ballpark, what does the other team think? You know, what's getting off that bus? For us, it's controlling the strike zone. Now, within that concept of controlling the strike zone, you have huge room for the individual player to be who he is and to work off of his strengths. So you're definitely you're trying to thread a needle to some extent to create the identity, but to also allow for the individual player to be who he is.
I would say that, we've been fortunate with the White Sox. We've had a lot of our coaches at the major league level that have been part of the organization a long time. And coaching staff throughout the minor leagues, coaches that have been there a fair amount of time as well. So in terms of really understanding what our pitching philosophy is, what our hitting philosophy is, it's been fairly easy to be consistent with a message. Now with that being said, you know, some other organizations, some that I've been with, there tends to be more turnover at the major league level just because of it's kind of the nature of the business. So if you choose to let the major league club kind of dictate the philosophies, sometimes, let's say a coach is there, a hitting coach is there for 4 years, and a pitching coach is there for 3 years, and then you bring in a new guy, and he has his new philosophy, and you're just, you know, you're overhauling, and you're changing things down at the minor leagues. It gets messy. So typically, ideally, you really want to have your foundational beliefs that are core and then driven to the organization at the minor league level, and then hopefully that then grows towards the major league side. So I think we're kind of unique in the sense that we've had guys around, and we can kind of build from top down, but in different cases, you can do kind of the bottom-up approach more times than not. Maybe you should.
All right, I leave you guys with this, and he mentioned Ben Broussard. In 2006, the Cleveland Indians' first baseman was a platoon of Ben Broussard and Eduardo Perez. Eduardo Perez gets traded to the Seattle Mariners for Asdrubal Cabrera, still playing. Ben Broussard gets traded for Chu, still playing. One position, you get two guys that made a lot of money and a lot of impact in the game. Boy, what a bad trade that Seattle Mariners made. Fortunately, you weren't there. I want to thank you both for being here, and I want to thank you guys for the questions. And again, this year it was an honor being here at the Sabre Conferences. So thank you.